I built the very first rifle that was square bridged, the very first square bridge custom rifle with my name on it in 1998. And I produced a little tiny brochure and so on and so forth. And those same five models were in that original brochure. And now there's a sixth because there's one more.
Welcome to the Blue Collar Voices Show. Today's show, we are talking with Patrick Houlihan. Pat has been a practicing gunsmith for a long time. His love affair with guns started as a young child. He completed 3 years of college education in gunsmithing, a 2-year standard course with a 3rd year more advanced. From there, he worked a few different jobs, learning and refining, and then circumstances arose where he had to make a choice. Pat's choice? Working for himself, and he wouldn't have it any other way. The custom rifles created by Pat are from his own portfolio with limited deviations within. His work is not only loved because of the quality, functionality, durability, and craftsmanship, Pat creates works of art. Pat, in this episode, shares knowledge and insights, and I would love to be in his shop with him showing me all of this stuff in person. Maybe someday. In this episode, Pat and I were joined by my son, Destin. And we started recording and just talking before the show really began, and I decided it would be cool to hear a bit of that, so that is what you hear first. So, let's get rolling.
Yeah, Destin's very talented. He's a music teacher, but he can play the piano, the ukulele.
He plays
trumpet. He's a trombone extraordinaire.
I do not play trumpet.
What did you start with?
You know, actually, when I was 10 years old, I started with guitar, and my dad, actually, the guitar, I'm going to open the door, Dad, and show you this. I don't know if you remember.
Okay.
You bought this for me Christmas 1 year. It's an Epiphone guitar, and that was after 2 torturous months of playing the same tune over and over again, which goes a little something like this to my dad. And so that little tune, it's actually from a rap song, which I had no idea. And so my friends in the neighborhood played it, and I copied them. And I played that over and over and over again. And finally, they got me in lessons and bought that guitar. Cool. So that's how it started. And then 12 years old, I was in 6th grade, and we start band here in Texas. And so I started playing trombone, played it through middle school, high school. And then I went to Tarleton State and got a music education degree. So that was my primary instrument. And they taught us, they taught us how to play other instruments. That doesn't mean I'm good at it. But
did you actually take up the piano?
I feel like I'm just dabbling, but mm-hmm. I took a few lessons in college and I can play.
How much has mom helped you?
So it's just going to be on the podcast. she's given me a few pointers.
Is she a piano player?
Well, yes. She went to a Bible college, back in the 80s. And she mainly plays for church, but she really plays an organ. And she's taught me a few things, but really it was all independent study. And of course, both of my parents encouraged me. So
yeah, that's excellent. That's excellent. I tried it with all three of mine. It got nowhere. Well, that's not true. I mean, it got them through like junior high, and the youngest one carried into high school for a little while and then finally gave it all up.
Right. So,
but I guess I really shouldn't say anything because that's kind of the way it went. My mom started all of us on the piano when we were 4 and 5 years old. So
nice.
That carried all the way into high school for all of us. And then in high school, we all kind of just sort of, I don't know if just disillusioned stopped. But, you know, once you have 10, 12, 14 years of lessons under your belt, it's kind of with you for the rest of your life.
It absolutely is.
Sure.
From an educational standpoint, it it matures the brain, develops the brain in various ways that you just wouldn't get if you didn't play an instrument.
No, I think it's, you know, the kids, I started both. I started the middle one and the youngest one in orchestra. And I had, about, I don't know, a half a dozen years of orchestra behind me when I was that age.
Right.
And then the youngest one, he took piano lessons for a while, but he stuck with the cello till he was sophomore in high school, I guess. And then the middle one stuck with the violin till she was, I think, a freshman in high school, something like that. So,
yeah.
So they've got that in them anyways. I mean, they've learned how to read music, and, you know, they've been through that period of time where I'm pretty sure that it'll benefit them in the future.
That's one of my goals as a music educator. Of course, it's not a music education podcast, but we're going to go ahead and talk about it. But
I'll edit it out.
Oh, good. Good. That's one thing that I tell my students is you may not want to play an instrument or sing or anything, but at least you have some sort of appreciation and you can make better choices so that you're not just listening to Justin Bieber on the radio and think it's good music. You know, you can upgrade to something a little better.
Yes. No, it's a good thing. And I've dabbled with it. We bought a piano and stuck it in the living room. And I was the dabbler when it came to the guitar. I never took lessons much anyways. But I've always had a couple of guitars around and I just kind of bang around and sort of make it up as I go. And that's sort of been the sum total of it. But the piano thing, once you've got so many years behind you, it's hard to just give it up forever.
That's one thing that is missing, I think, in a lot of households. Of course, my father here was useless as far as music. you know, great in technology. Yeah. You know, I learned how to build a computer. I just didn't. You know, families used to gather around a piano at night and sing. And it wasn't like just rich people. It was families and communities. They all had, you know, their little instruments. It doesn't matter how out back the family was. They created instruments. That's how you got a lot of the jank looking instruments, blowing in bottles and things. I mean, that's not sophisticated, but it's something that a lot of families used to do. And it's
was my
cool
whole growing up period of time was, you just described it, especially in the holidays, you know, Christmas time, things like that. My mom at the piano.
Yeah.
Both my parents were into singing in the choir the whole time I was growing up and all that stuff. So they had us in there doing it too until we could escape.
But, you know, one thing I would add to that. So this is something that I do with my students. I show them a picture. Well, we do a musical every semester and I have a whole new group of students every semester and I show them a picture of Wolverine and they're like, okay, you know, Mr. Chapman, why are you showing us Wolverine? They're confused. And then I say, who is this? And they're like, oh, yeah, that's Wolverine. I say, okay, what's his real name? They say, Hugh Jackman. And then I say, all right, how did Hugh Jackman get started? And they're like, I have no clue. You know, they think he just started on Wolverine or whatever. And I say, no, he started on Broadway. And then I proceed to show them, I think it's from 1999 or 2000, a YouTube video of him singing Oh, What a Beautiful Morning from the musical Oklahoma.
Kidding. Well, there you go. I just learned something.
So, yeah.
I would have never expected that myself.
No.
And so what I tell them is, all right, boys, if you think you're too manly to sing or too cool, then you think you're cooler than Wolverine. And they usually get a few of them interested. So.
Yeah, that's great.
That's pretty cool.
That's great. Yeah.
Fun stuff.
No kidding. No, it is.
I had no idea you had that kind of insight, Destin.
Yeah, man. Got a college degree. I learned a few things, hopefully.
That's awesome. Hey, Destin.
That's funny.
Your mic is definitely still pretty hot. If you could move the mic back a little bit.
Okay. I think I can turn the sensitivity down as well.
You can go ahead and turn it off.
Oh, good. Well, let me just do this. Is this fine?
It sounds good. Yeah.
Okay.
That's fine.
It's a little bit away from my face, and that way you can't hear me breathe anyway.
Okay. As you can tell, Patrick, I love my son, and we like to riff on each other. And it's he's a true treasure. I mean that sincerely.
Fantastic.
About time I get the appreciation that
you don't deserve. So, Patrick, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. And today we have another surprising guest, which is my son, Destin. So I'm delighted to have both of you here on the show today. Destin's my son. He is an interested party. Patrick is our main guest today. He is a gunsmith, and we're going to discover more about how he got started in this particular career, what he does, and aspects to this whole gunsmithing. And of course, as always, it'll be a meandering conversation, and we're going to learn little snippets and pieces. So Patrick and Destin, welcome to the Blue Collar Voices Show.
Hey.
So Patrick, let's just go ahead and get started in the aspect of what exactly is it that you build?
I build classic rifles. I build classic bolt action hunting rifles. I've got 6 models in my line. Everything's done primarily around a Winchester Model 70 platform. I don't know exactly how in-depth you want me to go on explaining this part of it. My interest in this business was always around hunting, so I wanted to build hunting rifles. I really appreciated, you know, the art form of a good, clean, classic rifle. So I worked for a rifle maker for about 4 or 5 years, and we were just kind of all over the place. We built on just about anything. But while I was working with him, I got the chance to watch a lot of other builders and sort of start to develop an idea as to what I wanted to do. So I build on a few Mauser platforms and one Dakota platform, but just almost everything else I do is on a Winchester Model 70.
To break that down a little bit further, what components of your production do you not make? I mean, how into detail or how many of the components?
So obviously I start with a Winchester Model 70 action. So what I do is basically remove all of the parts. And the only thing that I start with is just the action alone. One of the aspects of my rifles, which is kind of my own little thing, and as far as I know, there are no other custom builders doing this, and that is that I square bridge the Winchester Model 70 action. So what that means is I add metal to it, and I machine an integral scope mounting system into it. So as I build the action, there's a few things that I do. I what I call accurize the action. Now within the industry, there are a lot of fancier technical terms for this. People call it blueprinting, and there's a variety of different descriptions when it comes to this. But primarily what I do is I remove the old threads and I put new threads in on center. I recut the lug surface. I recut the bolt face. When it comes to the bolt, I add a bolt handle to it. So I cut the original bolt handle off. And there is a company in Colorado by the name of McFarland. So I use their bolt handles. They turn out a bolt handle that is checkered, and you can get it in a variety of forms. I only use one form. It's a 4-panel, what they call a 4-panel checkered bolt knob. So I add the McFarland checkered bolt knob to the bolt handle. Sometimes I will remove the trigger system and put an aftermarket trigger system in it. It depends on what age the Winchester action is. That action was built kind of in 3 different models, so to speak. The original Model 70 has always been termed the pre-64 Model 70, so that was the first one. They stopped building that action. The ideal feature of that action was it's called a controlled round feed action, so it has a claw extractor to it. And I prefer to build on only controlled round feed actions. There are some aspects to that that I believe make it a more reliable action. So I stick to just the controlled round feed actions. They quit building the controlled round feed action in 64, and then they picked it back up again in the 80s. So there was the second group of Winchester Model 70s. And then in the 90s, they stopped making that action and they started building another one with some refinements to it. So I have three different groups of Winchester Model 70s that I work with. And based on the changes that went on with those, depends on what kind of parts I put into them when I'm actually building the action up. So the action is the first thing that I start with. So sometimes, like I say, I'll add aftermarket triggers depending on which group of action I'm using. And then there's a company in Wisconsin called Sunny Hill Enterprises, and they build a bottom metal that was originally designed by a gentleman whose last name was Grizzle. So I really like the lines of the Grizzle style bottom metal. So I use Grizzle style bottom metal done by Sunny Hill Enterprises. Then I'll frequently replace the magazine box, the springs, and the followers. So I rebuild the action in its entirety. Back into the accuracy part of it, I'll recut the bolt face and lap the lugs. And when I'm done, I have a real true action on center. And then the next step is the barrel. And so I don't build my own barrels. I use a company also in Wisconsin called Krieger Barrels. And they build what I consider to be one of the finest cut rifle barrels in this country, maybe the world. And so I just about exclusively use Krieger barrels on my actions. Once the barrel's installed, the metal is pretty well done. It's in its complete form. And that description right there kind of answers your question. No, I'm not building those parts. I'm a one-man show. Now, that doesn't mean anything. 100 years ago, a one-man show still had to build all his own parts because he did not have access to all of these aftermarket parts. But I do. And so it allows me to integrate some really, really nice product into my metal. So I think that kind of answers your question. No, I'm not actually. I'm doing a lot of customizing. I machine the bridges. I machine those integral bridges to accept tally rings, which is a nice, real high quality split ring made by a company here in the United States also. And
no Chinese companies, huh?
Excuse me?
No Chinese companies or foreign companies.
I don't know what to say about that. But no, everything I use is definitely American made.
Okay.
Excellent.
Some people like that.
Well, you know, the only area where I deviate from that is when I build a rifle for a person, they have a choice. They can either send me a scope or I help them choose one. And I have been working with Swarovski Optic North America for years, since the beginning of my building. And so I'll put a Swarovski on there. So there you go. There's an Austrian made scope, you know, okay. An out of country scope. That's the only part that goes into what I do that does not reflect American made.
Okay.
You know, I'm going to be square with you. I mean, if somebody else made super high quality, high end parts that I could integrate in, you know, into a nice, clean, classic rifle, you know, I'd use them. I've just gone out and searched and found and used what I think is the best materials possible.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, you know, that's sort of a description. There's a lot of customizing going on, you know, in my scope mounting system, which is a repeatable scope mounting system. You can take the scope off and put it back on, and generally within an inch, it'll always go back in the same place. And but everything is definitely put together with materials, you know, from outside vendors.
What kind of equipment do you use to machine?
I've got a couple of mills. I've got a couple of mills and a couple of lathes, and then just a lot of small bench type stuff and whatnot. So within all of that action work, you know, machining out the scope mounting and whatnot is always done on the mill. I flute my own barrels, so that's done on the mill. When you're cutting threads and chambering and doing that kind of work, it's done on a lathe. So I do, you know, I fit all the barrels. I get the barrel in a profiled blank form. So it's got the hole cut through it and it's got the rifling in it, and there'll be something done to the outside of it. Sometimes I might change that a little bit, but I have some theories related to quality of integrity when it comes to steel. And I try really hard to kind of stay away from doing a whole lot of outside profile work once it's already been done. Those folks know how to stress relieve barrels after they're done. They cryo them. The company that builds my bottom metal, I build two models in my line that are heavier rifles. One of them I call my African Hunter, and one of them I call my Safari Hunter. The African Hunter incorporates an action that is the only other action that I ever use, simply because I don't like putting super large cartridges with boxes that require boxes of that size on a Winchester Model 70. So I use a Dakota action, and the Dakotas were an action designed by a guy who basically followed the Winchester Model 70 profile. And then he just made some minor modifications, but also they did just a fantastic job of building the action. So I start with this big Dakota action that looks like a Winchester Model 70. And I use that for my African Hunter in the large cartridges. And then the Safari Hunter is the next step down. And these are what they call deep box guns. So they're a little bit bigger and heavier. The belly is deeper. It offers you an extra round of ammunition in the magazine. So that's the way that goes. So all of the machine type work as far as the scope mounting is done on the mill, and then the rest of it is done on the lathe. And as far as the barrels and whatnot go, other than the fact that I do flute my barrels and then I recryo them afterwards, on those large rifles, the company that builds my bottom metal profiles the barrels also. And they are fully integral, and they have a barrel band style front sight, a barrel band sling swivel stud, a second lug, which is built on the barrel, a rib that's on the top, and then it's machined to accept open sights. And that entire piece is machined out of one piece of steel. So these folks do that machining for me on my two large rifles. And that's pretty much it.
I have a question. I'm not sure if you discuss this. And now, I don't know much about guns, but would the stock be the part that you're actually holding on to when you fire the weapon?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. So did you mention anything about the stock?
No, I haven't gotten to that part yet, because that's where that's the stock part of it is kind of the all me part.
Okay. I'm slightly interested. Well, not slightly. I'm interested because I dabble in woodworking on the side.
Yeah.
And that's something that comes up every now and then on the forums that I'm a part of. Mm-hmm. It's custom stock. So,
well, there's guys out there that would maybe not look at me as being a purist custom rifle builder. some people build stocks from blanks. What the term is used to build a stock from a blank. And then others build stocks from semi-inlets. All of my stocks that I work with are semi-inlets. Now, the way they get to that point, though, is I build a pattern that has all of the dimensions that I want within each one of the models. And I'll give a quick description there. I have six models in my line. Five of them are wood-stocked guns, which is primarily what people come to me for. I build one synthetic-stocked rifle I call my Alpine Hunter, and I think I've probably put together maybe three or four of them in the last 20 years. Nobody comes to me for synthetic because it's not what my reputation is about. On the other five woodstock guns, those patterns for those rifles I have built from scratch. And then I take the pattern in a blank and I put it in a duplicator. Or I shouldn't say I put it in a duplicator. I send it to a guy that does all of my duplicating. So he's got a single spindle machine. He puts my pattern in one side. He puts the blank in the other side and turns out what's called a semi-inlet. And the semi-inlet, though it looks by appearances to be quite finished, still requires a tremendous amount of hours if you want to end out with a really super nice piece when you're done.
The duplicator sounds like it's almost like a CNC machine.
It's a pantograph. It's not a CNC. CNC is computer controlled. This duplicator is a pantograph. So this guy has my pattern on one side, and he has a stylist over there on that side that's following all the surfaces inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
And on the other side, he's got this head that's kind of like a router head, and it's got cutters that are, of course, replaceable because you need to use different types and sizes of cutters for different areas in the stock as you do your turning. And he's over there by hand running this thing on that blank, cutting away the wood while the stylist is over on the pattern following the lines of the wood. So he basically duplicates what's in the pattern.
Mm-hmm.
Is that description sufficient?
Sure.
Okay. I just want to make sure I was clear. Whereas, you know, when you're talking CNC type machines, these are all computer automated. They're something that you write a program for. As an example, those two right. barrels that I told you that the company in Wisconsin does for me, the deep box rifles that I build, they're the integral barrels. Now those barrels are turned on a CNC machine. He has written a program and installed it into his mill, and they stick their billet in and away it goes.
Yeah. The duplicator is a mechanical process.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's a pantograph, and in that same theory is used actually in a lot of industries.
I'm thinking of the handwriting. That's they have this.
You got it. Like in the jeweler, say a jeweler wants to scribe on your bracelet, your name or something like that. He's got a pantograph. And so he's got letters there, and a stylist follows those letters, and a tip cuts the same letters into your jewelry.
In the jeweler situation, it could be a reduction, like the letters are bigger, absolutely. But yet on the other end, it
absolutely. You can do a lot with it. I have one that I use because I actually use it to put letters on my action and my barrel when I'm completely finished. And then I take it over to my engraver, and he'll deepen them or add gold or whatever.
Interesting.
You ever put names in them?
I do. Yeah. You know,
cool.
Not as much complete names on rifles, but letters, initials, you know, say your two or three initials, whatever you desire, and different places on the trigger bow, on the grip cap, sometimes other places. But I have my name on the barrel, and then I have the caliber on the other side. And then on the action, I have what I call that particular style rifle on it. So I've machined off what was actually originally there, done by the manufacturer. So I put their information back on also in lettering. And the serial numbers. Now, you can't actually remove the serial numbers, so I'm real careful to leave that alone. But my engraver will go back over those and deepen them and clean them up and just make them look good.
And you can't, because that's a felony, right?
Yeah, that's basically it. They don't like it. There's just no humor with the BATF in removing serial numbers. Yeah, so.
Let's say I want to come in. You know, I'm married. This is hypothetical. And I want to get my girlfriend a rifle, a custom rifle, but I want it to be hot pink and say hot mama on the side. Can I do that?
You can. You're just not going to be able to do it here. But I guarantee you there is somebody out there that will do it for you.
Yeah. Okay.
No problem. You know,
I'm making a joke, but here in Texas, I mean, all the time, there's pistols and such that are like zebra print and pink.
Oh,
and
I know it. Oh, they've gotten crazy. Yeah. Yeah. No, they've gotten really imaginative when it comes to stuff like that. Every color and shape and pattern you can think of.
Should have known you'd come up with that, son.
You raised me.
Yes. Yes, I did.
Oh, there's a lot of that stuff out there. Maroon and purple and pink. And the ladies that enjoy shooting and hunting, they like to show that stuff off.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And even college affiliations. I thought of A&M when you said maroon. So.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Yeah.
Now, well, earlier you had mentioned Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, no, you just brought back a memory of a gentleman that I've built some rifles for, and he had some pretty thorough engraving done on a couple of them. And he was a graduate of, shoot, I don't know, it might have been A&M. He'd shoot me for not being able to remember, because it's something that he's very proud of, and deservingly so, I'm sure. But I don't remember exactly which Texas university it was. But he had us put the logo on the bottom metal, engrave it, and it was done in extreme detail, and it was pretty nice looking.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I would say that you have your core things that you do, but you probably have innumerable little customizations that people ask for.
Some, you know, but then on the other side of that coin, frequently people will come, and I guess this is how I handle most of that. You need to pick up one of my rifles and see how it feels and how it balances for you, and, you know, how it seems to fit and so on and so forth. And if you like what I do, then I'm your guy. And if you don't, well, there's probably somebody out there that can help you.
That's awesome. This is what I build. Maybe it works for you.
That's it. You know, I can't put what I put into a rifle very many times a year. It's the only way I can describe it. So I'm only building a very few pieces a year. I've built these patterns and these styles with a lot of forethought. Mm-hmm. When it comes to their applications. And once I've designed that rifle and the way it all goes together and how it fits and feels and functions and whatnot, I really don't want to be caught up altering and changing and doing this and doing that. You know, my checkering patterns, I'll change here and there for folks and whatnot, depending on what they might want. And sometimes a guy might want a little bit of a palm swell put into his stock. But past that, I don't get real crazy. Sometimes I'll change the cheek piece a little bit if he wants an oval style, European style cheek piece versus the more American style cheek piece. Maybe I'll add an initial plate to the bottom of the stock instead of putting the initials on the trigger bow or the grip cap. But these are very minor changes and enhancements. When people start to get outside of that, I suggest that they try to find somebody else that might want to do that. Just because it's just a time thing. There's little enough made at the hours I put in now, and to start fiddling with these one of a kinds just dramatically adds hours.
So when you started out, I would presume that you didn't have all of these designs initially, and these, you kind of come across these. How many years did it take for you to formulate these different basic, these six or seven different basic designs, the six without the synthetic?
Well, the only way I can answer that is to say I worked as a repair and minor custom gunsmith for 7 or 8 years. And then I went and I worked with a custom rifle builder for, let's say, 4.5, 5 years, somewhere right in that neighborhood. When I left his shop, and I didn't want to leave his shop, it was just he decided it was time to close his doors, and I had to either, you know, figure out how I was going to do this or go get a real job, one of the two. And the real job thing didn't sound all that appealing. So
it never is.
Yeah. So I, you know, I decided to try and go it on my own, and that was in 1994. And I already, even at that time, right, had started envisioning what I wanted to do. I knew I needed to find some things that were a little bit set apart from everybody else just so that they would stand out. And that's kind of where the scope mounting thing came. It's funny that happened on a hunting trip, because I also guide hunters. I do a little bit of hunting outfitting at this point, but back then I was not an outfitter. I was just a guide that did work for other outfitters. I was paired up with this guy who was an extreme gun enthusiast and who had done some work with a custom, very prominent custom rifle builder. And so we spent 4 or 5 days, you know, he was a hilarious guy too. Mostly all I was is in tears for 5 days, but We threw these different ideas back and forth and whatnot. And what I got out of that particular hunting trip, other than a good friend and some great memories, is the idea to square bridge my rifles and sort of add a little aspect to them that was a little bit different than what anybody else was doing. So after that feature kind of came into my mind, and I was still working for the other rifle builder, I'm looking around and I'm thinking this onesie thing was not in my mind at that time a real practical way to try to attempt to earn a living. And so I started looking at how other people were doing it. And there's some guys out there that in this industry, top of the line guys that are only building one or two models. And then some guys are just all over the place. They'll do anything you come up with. And so mm-hmm. I knew, you know, I needed to kind of, so when bottom line to your the answer to your question is, by the time I left his shop, I already kind of had most of it formulated. Now, little features, the features of whose outside vendor product I was going to incorporate and so on and so forth, that is all developed over a period of time. But five of the models that I have right now, I had kind of in my head when I left there. And
okay.
I built the very first rifle that was square bridged, the very first square bridge custom rifle with my name on it in 1998. And I produced a little tiny brochure and so on and so forth. And those same five models were in that original brochure. And now there's a sixth because there's one more. So in reality, the actual styles of the rifles that I build, which I'll just go over them real quick. There's the large rifle that I told you about called the African Hunter, which handles the real large cartridges, and then the Safari Hunter. And then I build a rifle I call my Classic, which is your basic, you know, classic style bolt action hunting rifle. And then on that Winchester, they only make two size actions. So they have a standard and a short. So on all the rifles they build on their short action, I call my lightweight Classic because it incorporates finer, lighter lines. Now, those four rifles are all done on high-end walnut when it comes to the stock work.
Okay.
And so those are my four high-end Classic rifles is what it amounts to. And then the fifth rifle is what I call my long-range Hunter, and it's just built along a little bit heavier lines, fluted barrel, so a little bit heavier barrel, and it's done in a laminate, so it's not on, you know, fine walnut. And I call that one my long range hunter. And then there's the lightweight gun that I brought up earlier that I call my Alpine Hunter that's done strictly in synthetic. And it's interesting because, well, hunters' values and ideas have changed a little bit since I started building rifles. And the guys that were building rifles, you know, in the 40s and the 50s and the 60s, even, you know, all the way up to about the 80s, you know, they were building the best classic or woodstock custom rifle that they could build and putting it in hunters' hands. And hunters took them and they went hunting. And, mm-hmm. you know, some guys are just better at taking care of things than others. So some guys didn't beat them up, but some guys just didn't care. The bottom line was there were hunting rifles. No matter what you put into it for a money value, they're a hunting rifle. And folks took them and they hunted with them. And I have to say, I still really appreciate that mentality. Nowadays, probably 95% of everything I do has a second stock on it in synthetic. And I won't build any of those rifles in synthetic to start with. But if they order a rifle and they want to add a synthetic stock to it, then I'll do that. And a lot of guys are doing that and taking the metal out of the wood and putting the wood in the gun case and putting the metal in the synthetic and taking it hunting so that they don't beat up that beautiful wood stock. So
okay.
The ideas have changed a little bit. You know, folks are a little – they're just leery of beating up. And I have to say, prices in fine classic rifles have changed a lot in the last 40 or 50 years. So that does have something to do with it. You know, they're putting, you know, a pretty good amount of money into these. So they just don't want to beat up a gorgeous piece of wood.
Sure. And how much, when they get the synthetic stock, is it just like a basic stock that conforms to what's needed? Or is there a lot of effort into the synthetic secondary stock?
You know, that's an area that I'm actually still evolving in. But I work with one company. I work with McMillan, you know, and they build all my synthetic stocks. And not so much now, but even years ago, there was a gentleman that was working for them that had a lot to do with product development, and he actually brought me in and had me checker some of their patterns and whatnot that they build their molds with, and so on and so forth. So I had some little minor influence in a few of the stocks that they have on the market today. I like what they do. They've got model designs and quality that incorporate really well into my rifles. And I'm not going to get into this right now, but I have ideas as to how I even plan on trying to make those a little classier as time goes by.
Sure.
But I start with a Macmillan stock. That's what I do. And I could have my own stocks built. They'll do that. I can build patterns and they'll turn stocks out. But I just flat don't turn enough of them out to warrant the cost of having my own stock designs built by a synthetic stock company. So I go with the models that they have, and they've done a really good job both in materials and design. You know, they've thought through the stocks that they build. And so the ones that they have designed that work with my style of rifle are, you know, very accommodating.
You have a thought? Go ahead.
Well, I was thinking, this is very interesting because I'm a trombone player, and we got into that earlier, but really any type of musician, they go through the same process. And you can go to Walmart. Well, you can't go to Walmart. You can go to Guitar Center, or you can order off Amazon, you know, these pretty standard instruments and things. And you know, you can do the same with guns. You can order pretty standard stuff that you want. But whenever you get down to something that fits you, you go to the shop and you try out every little part.
Sure.
And it's
similar.
There's nothing like getting fitted for the type of instrument that you want, because you know this is going to fit you and it's made specially for you. And it may just be a combination of different parts that are also standard. It's not like they're sitting there, oh, we need to adjust this, adjust that. I mean, it's all parts and you can just piece it together. I'm thinking of a company called Edwards. They create some really great trombones, and you can go to an Edwards shop and they'll piece it for you. You can play on it and they'll spend hours with you. And, you know, $5,000 later, you have
your own
trombone.
Well, thinking about that process and with your building the guns, do you have people that may request like a lighter pull or a harder pull, that type of thing?
Yeah, they do. And so within reason, I'm willing to work with that. But there's kind of a line where I quit, you know, just from a safety point of view.
Sure. You said that you put on an aftermarket bolt. And, well, another handle on the bolt then.
Right. It's just the handle. That's all I replace.
Why do you replace that handle if it's a perfectly good handle? What is the point of that? And if so, do people request that handle put on in different, like maybe a little bit longer, a little bit shorter, anything like that?
Nope. I've never had anybody ask me anything like that. And when it comes to maintaining, say, as an example, the factory bolt handle versus this four-panel checkered bolt handle that I put on, I don't give them a choice anymore.
Okay.
If they like my four-panel checker bolt handle, then my rifle's for you. If they don't, well, then it's not. And sure. It's just, you know, and that's a relatively minor detail, but that's
your process.
That's where I've gotten. Now, I used to be a little more accommodating, but I've kind of, as the years have gone by, I've gotten a little bit stiffer in just, you know, what my rifle's going to look like when it goes out the door.
And I imagine you have the business where you can say, no, I'm not making that. I make them like this.
Yeah, that's it. You know, people kind of know that now, not necessarily even from talking to me, but just they don't come and ask me if I will make great alterations to what I do too much anymore. And sometimes they do, but not very often, not very often. And again, I'm, you know, kind of this sort of plays into a question you've already asked you know, what we were just talking about related to the music industry. It's evolving. I mean, you know, I'm constantly changing little this or that and not even in a major way, little lines, you know, especially like as an example in my stock work. Okay. there's a lot to doing a final, you know, shape and sand and finish of a stock. And there are a lot of dimensions within a rifle stock, a lot of dimensions. And so sometimes I might change little minor characteristics as I go along, you know, come up with something a little tiny bit different that I like the looks of a little bit better or the feel of a little bit better. So it's not like I haven't reached a stopping point. It's something that just sort of changes minorly as time goes by.
Is a stock, or does it have to be adjusted a bit for each individual?
Length of pull is the most important aspect of it. There are some dimensions that are relatively important. You know, there's drop and there's the change in the angles on the rear, on the butt, in the heel, in the toe. Those kinds of things, the cast off, so on and so forth, they're there, and those parts won't change a lot. I can change the angles a little bit on the buttstock, but the length of pull is where it really gets important, and that's what I will try to fit to each individual customer to make sure that we're getting them into the correct length of pull. Basically, the length of pull affects where the rifle is positioned in your shoulder and how you reach up and grab hold of the trigger, how your face fits into the stock. So if it's a little too short or a little bit too long, it's going to be uncomfortable and not function well when you shoot. So you're trying to find that perfect fit in that area.
Now, earlier you're talking about, you know, putting on the scopes and things like this. And I'm curious, I'm not remembering quite correctly, but are you actually altering the barrel, or does the scope mount to something else completely?
The scope mounts to the receiver. So this machining that I was describing where I add this metal, basically the way the process goes is I take the action, okay, and your action has a front and rear bridge, and that's where your standard aftermarket scope materials mount to, your bases and your rings and your scope. Generally, in today's world, they're all drilled and tapped. Now, years ago, that wasn't necessarily the case. So you actually had to take it to a gunsmith and get him to drill and tap hole, you know, drill holes and tap the holes so that you could then buy bases, screw them to the receiver, put your rings on, put your scope in your rings, and you were ready to go. So now what I do is I actually add metal to those two areas. So my first process is, I take two blocks of steel that are of the same construction of steel used in the receiver, and we weld those in place. And I have a Heliart guy, an inert gas welder, that is really, really, really good. All right. I mean, many, many gunsmiths weld, you know, Heliart, and I wanted somebody doing this particular work that was just kind of set above when it came to quality. And this guy, he welds jet engine parts for a living. And he was one of the first guys in this Tucson area to be licensed to be able to work on a lot of these jet engines and actually weld and then have that stuff pass inspection and so on and so forth. So his ability is he's absolutely a magician with a torch. I mean, he can weld with anything, but for this particular application, it's an inert gas welding and a Heliart. So he welds those two blocks of steel to the receiver, and then I ship the receiver off to a company in Utah who anneals the receiver. So they soften this receiver for me, and they send it back to me, and I put it in a jig that I've built in my mill, and I machine it out to accept the tally rings that I was telling you about. And I actually make a little bit of a change to the rings. I add a little underlug to them so that I can machine the outside of this whole thing to give it a specific appearance. I wanted it to be as streamlined and clean and less blocky, so to speak, as I could. So I took an idea that I had seen from another manufacturer and then applied it to the tally rings, because I don't think there's really anybody else out there that builds a vertical split ring any better than Tally does. They build a beautiful set of rings. And then I machine those blocks to accept those rings. And then I take that receiver and I send it back to the heat treating company in Utah along with the bolt, and they reheat treat the whole action. So now I have a good, clean, heat treated action that has been square bridged and accepts these rings. The advantage to this is that everything is mated up. It's not just a physical appearance. The physical appearance, in my estimation, is nice, but mechanically, what you have now is you have a mating that's done that is really so well fit that you can take that scope off and then put it back on. And on the paper at 100 yards, it'll usually, if not almost always, shoot within an inch of where it was shooting when you took it off with no adjustments. So it's mm-hmm. very, what I call, repeatable. And sometimes, mm-hmm. often it'll, I tell people an inch. I've seen them shoot right back in the same hole many times, but I don't advertise that it's going to do that because sometimes it'll be slightly off. There's two aspects to this. I've created an integral scope mounting system, which is very solid and durable, and offers an advantage to accuracy. And it's also really nice looking. It's real clean. And it just, to me, it just added a real nice touch to a classic rifle.
Very nice. Well, that kind of takes care of the mechanical side of things, I guess. Let's talk about the stock itself, the fine walnut, and the process that you use to just turn out something that looks exquisite. And I've seen your work on LinkedIn, and it's nice work.
Thank you. Okay. What can I tell you? I don't know.
You get the piece of wood in, and uh-huh. it doesn't have a finish on it or anything. And you said that you do a little bit more refinement on it.
Yeah.
And you're like, what kind of refinements are you doing? Right. How do you treat the wood? How do you protect it? And yeah. What makes it yours?
Well, okay. So first off, I buy everything in blank form, and I use, I primarily work with, Turkish walnut, English walnut, and Bastogne. Nowadays, and for several years now, the English and the Bastogne that I'm buying is California grown. It's not coming from Europe. So that's where the English and the Bastogne comes from. And then, of course, the Turkish walnut comes from Turkey. So you choose blanks. Blanks, really good quality, high-end blanks. They're not cheap. So you shop and you look and you find pieces that you want to add. And so you buy these blanks. Go ahead.
You're not getting something that's like full of knots and a little bit of rot.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I get a chance to take a look at it.
Each individual blank that you buy, are you pre-selecting that specific one?
Yeah, you bet. I get to look at pictures. And for that matter, I won't buy it if it's not an understanding that if they ship it to me and it doesn't look like what I thought it looked like, it's going to go back.
Okay.
When you're buying high-end blanks, you're usually spending a little bit of money. And yeah, if there's flaws in that blank that are just not going to work out, then I need – or maybe it's not quite as finely colored and figured as I was hoping it would be, then I want to be able to send it back. Mm-hmm. But I've only worked with a few guys in this industry over the years. And so once you develop a friendship/relationship, they're good about that. So I get these blanks in, and the first thing that I do is I boil them. And I learned this from a woodcutter, a stock blank cutter in California. And he learned it and passed it on to me from the veneer industry, as a matter of fact. He said to me one time, this was 10 or 15 years ago, and I met this guy through another rifle maker, super high-end classic rifle builder. He was the one that introduced me to this guy and helped me to develop this relationship. So we were all actually learning this other rifle maker that I'm talking about, who's quite a bit further along in years than I am and has built really fine quality rifles for many years. We learned this at the same time. from this guy. So he told, you know, we're talking about how blanks change. And this guy, we were buying wood from this guy in California, Green. So he was cutting these trees down, cutting them into blanks and driving them over here and selling them to us. Well, a wet piece of wood like that is always a risk. You're going to lose so many of them. Mm-hmm. It's just no doubt. Mm-hmm. Now, the nice thing about being able to buy absolutely green blanks was that the pricing was really good. So you didn't get hurt quite as bad, you know, when you lost one of those blanks as say nowadays, that particular source is gone now. And so I'm buying wood from cutters that have dried it and so on and so forth. And they're charging you for both the quality and the effort that they've got into producing that blank.
Right.
So anyways, we got to talking with him about how these blanks change and they'll twist and they'll curve and they'll warp and they'll crack and they'll this and that. And he said, well, these folks in the veneer industry, that they have to worry about that 10 times. And then you can imagine a guy's cutting, you know, 1/64th or a 32nd sliver of wood off of a top of a, you know, piece of wood. He wants to add that to, say, the outside of plywood, then he's going to, you know, he's building a piece of plywood that somebody can panel their, you know, trophy room with, their inside of their living room or their dining room or whatever, their office. And they want this nice, beautiful wood as the outside veneer layer. But that veneer is super, super hard to take care of. And, you know, that you talk about problems with cracking and splitting and warping and whatnot. When you have a little teeny tiny thin sliver of wood like that, all of the climate conditions alter that stuff dramatically. You're hot and you're cold and you're dry and you're wet will change this wood. So these veneer people, right, they line this stuff up on flat surfaces and they wet it down. They with a hot spray. They spray this stuff down. And then what ends up happening is all the oils and pitches and whatnot, you know, the tar and stuff that's inside the wood will seep out. That's what this hot steam, this hot spray will do to it. So he suggested we boil our blanks. And so that's what we started doing. And we did definitely find it to be an advantage in stabilizing wood. Now, sometimes you also get some little checks and cracks and whatnot, and that's not exactly ideal, but most of the time it's not an issue. So I'll take that blank and I've got a big tank. I can do a couple of blanks at a time in, and I'll boil them out for say 3 hours and then I'll pitch the water. And it's interesting to see what this water looks like after you've boiled a blank for 3 hours in it. It's like just full of this oil and all the stuff. That's the stuff that is altered by the climate changes. And then it will cause you problems. So then you dump it, you throw it back in for another 3 hours, you dump it, and now you've got now you let the blank dry out. Okay. So you let the blank dry, and then I have some outside dimension patterns that I've built that I'll lay on the blank and I'll draw and I'll go to the bandsaw and I'll cut these basic shapes out. It just reduces the overall size of the blank down to a more workable thing when it comes time to turn the stock on the duplicator. So now I've cut it. Mm-hmm. I give it just a basic sand. So I clean it up on the ends, on the sides, and then I spray some lacquer on it, a basic lacquer, so that when I hang it, you come along and you're shopping to build a rifle and you can go through my rack. And because of the way that I've taken care of it, you can actually see what's in the wood. Because I've sanded it and I've lacquered it, you can see all of the color and the figure as it will be relatively similar when we get it into a gun stock. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of guys do this in other ways. They'll take a raw blank and they'll spray it down with some water and they'll say, see how beautiful this is? But you can't. You can see it and it's nice. And I mean, then that's how I buy blanks, right? Because that's what mm-hmm. guys do. But when I'm trying to show customers blanks, I want them to get a real good idea of what they're going to see in that wood when we're done turning it. And then the last thing to do is the tip of it and the butt of it, I wax the ends so that it won't take on a lot of moisture or lose a lot of moisture, because that's part of that change of warping and cracking and so on and so forth that'll cause you problems. And right in the front of the grip, it's just an end grain. And so I'll wax it there, and then it's done. It's hung. I'll label it, you know, as far as how old the blank is and when I boiled it and when I bought it and so on and so forth, just so that I can kind of keep an eye on just how long I've had it. And I keep a logbook with all that stuff in it so that I can just verify what's what and so on and so forth. And that's it. So now that they're all hung up on hooks, and a guy can come in and, you know, here's 10 or 15 English and Bastogne blanks and 10 or 15, Turkish blanks, and he can look through there and we can talk about prices and he can have an idea of what he's looking at. And that's where it starts.
Excellent. So you got that full process back when you're 11 years old. You probably didn't think that you're going to be a gunsmith. How did that process come to happen? You know, we all have these varied paths in life, but yeah. You know, you got there.
Well, first off, I had these parents that were, well, they were both very educated, and both of my parents taught school, but they also really screwed me up as a kid because they told me that I should search for something that I want to do because I was going to have to do it for the rest of my life, working career. So okay. Do something you enjoy. Yeah. So my brother and my sister, now you got to understand, they both went and got good educations and they got good jobs and they've built great retirement. And I'm a gunsmith. I listened a little too closely, but, so I don't know, you know, my father really wasn't a hunter. He was a fisherman. He loved to fish and, you know, he had a fly rod in my brother and I's hands when we were adolescents. And for some reason, starting back when I was 4 or 5 years old, and I don't even know this for sure. My parents think it might have had something to do with the neighbor that we had back then because he was a hunter and I was very enthralled with him. I don't know. But I started bugging my dad for guns. That's when it started. And so he started me in the beginning with the old BB gun thing at 6 or 5 or 6 or whatever it was, or 7. And then he went back to school and got his PhD, and we moved to Colorado, Durango, Colorado. Well, Durango, Colorado is, at that point in time, this was in the early 70s, it was a hunting, fishing world is what it was. As a matter of fact, when I was in junior high school, I was in the 7th grade, and one of our required classes was a class called Environmental Living. In Environmental Living, you also took hunter safety. So we got hunter safety in school.
Oh, my goodness.
They taught us firearm safety in school. And you know, you have to remember the first weekend of deer season or elk season or the combination season, they took one day off. It was a 3-day weekend because it was hunting season, you know. So, and there was going to be a lot of kids that weren't going to show up to school anyways. So they made it a holiday. That was the kind of environment that I grew up in. Now, again, my dad wasn't really a big time shooter. I mean, he was a shooter and he'd done a little bit of hunting when he was young. His father passed away when he was real young. His father enjoyed hunting. And then, right out of high school, he joined the military and went to Korea and all that kind of stuff. And so he was a shooter and he had done a little bit of duck hunting and a little bit of upland game hunting, but he had a .22 and an old single shot shotgun in our closet. And that was the only two firearms he owned. And so, when I was whatever it was, 11, 12, 13, a lot of the professors that he taught with at the college were hunters, and some of them were very serious hunters. And one in particular went to our church. A couple of them did, actually. My dad kind of talked him into taking me under his wing, and that's how it started. I don't know what it is exactly, but I have just been literally addicted to shooting and hunting since I was very small. And, you know, in a fanatical, one of my very best friends, you know, he's just constantly jokes with me because it's just the way I've always been. I mean, it hasn't ever been a passing interest or a hobby. I've just been fanatical about it all my life. None of my kids ended out that way. I mean, they all like to shoot. They've all hunted. They all hunt. Now they don't all hunt. The middle one doesn't hunt a lot anymore. You know, I started them all shooting when they were 10 and they enjoyed the hunting. I don't know. Maybe I was too intense for them when they were young. I don't know. I hope that's not what happened, but just none of them ended out as fanatical as I was about it. It's just been something that's been on the forefront of my thinking since I was very, very young. So when I got out of high school, I originally thought maybe I wanted to go into wildlife, but I wasn't necessarily the greatest student in the world. And so I thought, well, I'll go to gunsmithing school. There was a gunsmithing school back then in a college. It was the only one in a college in the whole country. It was at Trinidad State Junior College. And it had a very good reputation. The instructors were, you know, had very good reputations.
Acceptable.
What's that? Yeah, exactly. Acceptable. But I'm, you know, it had some really high end guys that, you know, had big reputations within the shooting firearms industry and so on and so forth. And so, and that was right there in my home state. So I thought, well, I'll go there and then I'll pick up some college credits and whatnot, and maybe learn how to study. And, you know, when I'm done with this gunsmithing program, maybe I'll move on to, you know, biology and at a university. And so I went to school and I started learning how to build guns. You know, they teach you all that stuff, starting with basic bench metal and machine metal and stock making. And then there's, you know, all the sideline stuff that goes along with all that. And I did that and got the AAS degree, the 2-year degree. And then they had a 3-year program that they let the upper percentage of the class go to. And so I went to the 3-year program and we learned a lot about mechanics and so on and so forth in the 3-year program and did other things. And I got out of there and I decided that, you know, maybe I just really wasn't a school guy anyways. It wasn't totally that. I was actually talking to a counselor all the way through school. And at that time, in the late 70s and early 80s, which is when I went to gunsmithing school, there weren't a lot of jobs in the wildlife field. The way the federal spending was going at that time and so on and so forth, there just wasn't a lot of money to hire people. And my counselor actually told me, you know, I mean, you can go do this, but it's not the greatest job market in the world. And not that gunsmithing was. And all honesty, the way my thinking has changed over the last 40 years, if I would have gotten put back in that situation the way I think today, I'd have probably stuck with the wildlife, not because I liked wildlife better than I liked guns, but because today I don't believe that there's anything that you can't do if you want to do it bad enough. You know, it's just a matter of sticking with it until it works. I chose to go out into the gunsmithing field after I got out of school there. And, part of it's true. I was not at that point in my life. I was not a real school person. So the idea of more school and the fact that there weren't a lot of jobs in wildlife, and I just applied all over the country in gunsmithing, and I found a job in as a private contractor. They called it an independent private contractor. In other words, I was working on commission at a gunsmithing shop in a pretty big shooting store here in Tucson. And so I came down and interviewed and they gave me a job, and that's where it started.
And at that point, did you already understand how to use a mill and that type of thing?
You know, it's yes and no. Gosh, you know, being honest, the machine still kind of scared me at that point. I had very little time, on all of those different machines and so on and so forth. We'd done lots of projects and built lots of things and whatnot. But, you know, what I tell people, this is for me, okay? This may not be necessarily the case for some of the other students. And there was a lot of us. There was about 90 new gunsmithing students a year back then. So now that would dwindle down some, but, you know, still 2/3 of them ended up graduating every year from what started. So there was a lot of gunsmithing students going through that school. And there was a lot of guys, some of my best friends, you know, who I thought were probably more talented than I was. But I'm not exactly sure. Well, no, I am. Primarily, it's about finances. You know, most of them got out of school and looked at what they were going to make being a gunsmith and decided to go other ways. Mm-hmm. And so they did not pursue their whatever raw talent they might have seen within themselves while they were in school. There was some certain things about that whole experience that I really enjoyed the stock making. I loved the wood. That was my favorite thing. I wasn't necessarily the best. I mean, there was guys that were what I looked at as being much better than I was while we were in school. But the one area that we were definitely different is that I was going to go do that. And that was that. And I just wasn't going to quit until it worked out. So that's what I did. I got a job as a gunsmith. And what I realized after just a few years is that gunsmithing school prepared me to start learning gunsmithing when I got out of school.
Exactly.
That's what it did. And I'm not too sure that that's all that much different for most of the students. Now, some of them probably got away with a lot more skill and whatnot than I did, but it's still, it just kind of, the schooling just puts you on the road to start learning. I was fortunate enough to start working with a guy that was really good at repair work. He understood the mechanics of firearms, and he was a good minor custom builder too. You know, he could do a lot of minor custom work, and he could work well enough to make a good living gunsmithing. And that was just a God-given advantage right there. I mean, I was very fortunate to get to what people might call apprentice, so to speak, under him. Although I really, you know, I wasn't an apprentice. I got hired to do a job. I got given a bench and I got told I would make this much money on each job and get to it. But this guy was there to model for me, and he was willing to help me and teach me. After a few years, I watched, and I mean, shoot, the people that came and went through that bench, because there was three or four of us working full time there all the time. Nobody lasted. Some guys would last a few weeks, some guys would last a few months, but very few guys could come in there and blend into the variety of firearms and work that needed to be done and actually be able to turn out enough to survive. And so that's the way it went. And so for me, I stayed there. I learned, and I think back on it, and I've thought about this a lot, but for any guy that wants to venture into any custom field within the firearms industry, I think working in a standard repair shop for the first half a dozen years is worth its weight in gold, because you learn so much about function and mechanics and there's just so much to learn in a general shop like that, where you have the variety of work coming through that will be applicable to any specialized field that you take up later on. And I think you're ahead of most guys who don't get that opportunity.
How much of that time there impacted the design, your subsequent design that you did, where you alter it a little bit?
None. I mean, virtually none. Okay. None. Very little. I didn't know where I was going. I left there to go to work for this other rifle, this actual custom rifle maker. But I was just starting into like a whole new field when I went to work for him. I mean, I had all this stuff that I learned doing repair work and minor custom work for 7 or 8 years. And it was, like I say, I think invaluable and very applicable. But then I go to him, and it was funny. It was kind of like going backwards, because now all of a sudden he wants me to start doing this stuff that we'd learned how to do in school. And that was good. And so that's what I did. And from that first day on in his shop and being, being around that type of work, and then going to the shows with him and being around other rifle makers and starting to get to see what different rifle makers were doing throughout the country, that's when my real education started in me kind of formulating where I wanted to go with all this.
So when he brought you in, he knew good and well that he was going to have to teach you things, but yeah, you're doing work for him.
Yeah. But he also knew I had certain amount of talent, a certain amount of knowledge within gunsmithing that, you know, he thought would work, but he did.
When he had you come in and he's having you do things, some of that, I mean, what was the benefit to him to bringing you in?
The benefit to him bringing me in would probably be the same benefit that I would get today if I could find somebody like me. But what I've learned is, well, okay, so he built custom guns at a certain level, and he took in lots of orders and, you know, sold lots and lots of guns, and there was no way he could build them all by himself. He needed help. Okay. He just couldn't get the rifles out the door. He just absolutely had to have help. So that was good. And he had certain methods and ways of doing all the different parts. At first, he put me just into the woodworking world, and that was good, you know, and that's what I enjoyed, and that's where I really shined. And so he had me stocking and doing all the different aspects of stocking these rifles, and it was all bolt rifles, but of every make and model you can imagine. I mean, he just, you know, he'd do anything. I mean, he had some specialty areas. He was kind of known for large magnums, but he would use a variety of different actions and so on and so forth. And then he showed me his ways of doing that. And so I incorporated his ways with what things I had learned in the shop I'd been working in, with what I'd learned in school, and kind of formulated my own styles. And then he started me checkering, come to find out that I had an affinity, a talent for checkering. And I'd checkered in gunsmithing school, but not a lot. You don't checker a lot of rifles in gunsmithing school, and you get a relatively basic knowledge of what's going on. And I didn't know what I was capable of. And so he kind of helped me learn that. And so that was good. And we built some really nice showpieces too over the years, some, you know, some stuff for conventions and shows and things like that, and some really, really super high-end projects that we got into. And, you know, so I got to put my hand to those, and those were the kinds of things actually that started to develop my reputation.
Excellent. So at this point today, how many guns do you turn out a year?
Well, I tell people I can build 6, but I don't know if I've ever actually done that.
Wow. Yeah. In a year, not even 6.
What's that?
I said in a year, not even 6. That's correct. Like one gun per 2 months.
Yeah. Now remember, I'm doing a little bit of outfitting also. So I've got about 3 months worth of outfitting that's mixed up with a 12-month calendar.
Okay. Okay.
And then, and then I do other things for existing clients. All right. If I built rifles for this guy and he wants me to put a barrel on or do some accuracy work or, you know, fit a synthetic stock, I do a little bit of that for existing customers only. I don't take on new customers in that area because I just don't have the time to spend doing, you know, that kind of work. I need to be on the rifles. These guys order rifles and they'd like to get them done in a reasonable amount of time, which I rarely do, but I try hard and I never intentionally misspeak when I think that I can get something done. I just, over 60 years, the one thing I have never really learned is time. So anyways.
So when you're working in your shop, how many hours a day are you spending at the shop? If you have, let's say you had a week, all week long to just work on building guns, how many hours a day would you spend there?
That's the puzzle right there, isn't it? That's kind of the tricky part. And that is that if only I could just build guns, but when you run your own business, unfortunately, half the time my hands are on guns and half the time they're doing everything else that it takes to make things work. And that didn't answer your question very well, did
exactly.
it? But well, it gave you a theory anyways that has been something that I've been battling since the beginning. But
sure.
The fact of the matter is,
you could be arriving at 8 a.m. and leaving at 8 p.m.
And many times just sleeping on the couch, of which has never been a fanful experience of my wife, but yeah, I sleep here in the office often.
I understand.
Which makes me an public enemy number one at home, but I go home and, you know, my wife doesn't talk to me and my dogs give me dirty looks.
Now, do you ever decide, you know what, I can't work today, I'm going hunting?
You know what? I've gotten to the point where I don't do that too much anymore. Maybe I did that too much when I was younger, and that's why it's been so hard. I don't know. I did do that a lot when I was younger, but I don't anymore, unfortunately. I mean, I don't know, fortunately, unfortunately. I've actually become a little bit more responsible in that area.
You know, I respect so much the craftsmanship. It is, for me, just a true joy to hear the process of what you do, and not just you specifically, but craftsmen of different disciplines, and hearing how you apply that in the gunsmithing field, man, I just, it's awesome, dude.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. I love what I do. And so, you know, I'm probably going to be doing this as long as my hands and eyes work. I'd like to turn out a few more pieces before I'm done. I like the refining part of the process and trying to build a little bit better, little nicer looking rifle each time as time goes by. Then there's always, of course, that struggle of finding somebody that's willing to pay you for them.
Sure, but sure.
That part of it never ends. So, but it gets a little bit better and a little bit better as time goes by. I don't really look at myself as being all that much different than anybody else, other than tenacity, maybe. That's the sure. one aspect. You know, I'm just one of those that just doesn't know when to quit.
Right. Have you ever had the opportunity to pass on some of your knowledge to other people? As far as not just like a offhand conversation, but like really working with somebody to teach them things?
I haven't. No, I've hired some guys, and you know, over the last 25 years, I've been working for my 20, whatever it is, over 25 years that I've been working by myself. I've hired some guys, but you know, some were already gunsmiths and then some weren't. And so then, yeah, I did do some teaching and whatnot, but regretfully, I had never got lucky enough to find the guy that would fit into this niche that I'm working in, you know?
Right.
I don't know any other way to describe it. You know, I've had some really good guys that were super talented, but it takes a mentality to be willing to work on just a single piece for days and weeks and months at a time. A lot of folks just don't want to just stay on one thing and not get rich doing it. You know what yeah. I mean?
You know, you call it just one thing.
Yeah.
But if you break it down, you're not staying on just like always just one. It may be one rifle, but you know, you got all those different components.
Oh no, for sure. Beyond a shadow of a doubt. Sure. No, and that's how I see it. Absolutely. And that's how I work with it. But it's hard to explain, but you know, as an example, I had one guy that super talented that I thought was going to be the answer to me finally finding somebody to come in and mm-hmm. you know, turn 12 rifles out a year instead of six or whatever that case may be. Actually, even better, because I thought, well, you know, I'm the guy that's running the shop, so he doesn't have to deal with that. He can work. He preferred to apply his talents to the on and off style job, you know, the repairs and the stuff that just didn't take weeks and months. You know, he get on a job and be done with it in an hour or 2 hours or whatever, you know, and get on to the next one. And that's just where his talents laid and where his mentality was. It just ended up not working out really well and as far as being applied to this. And then past that, for some reason, I've just never gotten connected with a guy that's just really enthralled with custom classic rifles that I thought, you know, mm-hmm. I could bring in and make it work. Part of it's probably my own fear also. As an employer, it's a little scary sometimes, you know, knowing that you've got to come yes. up with the wages to pay yep. this guy week in and week out.
Without the aspect of having additional personnel to help you, are you pretty much topped out as busy as you can be with everything you're doing?
Yes, definitely. A couple years behind.
That's all?
Well, I don't even want to answer that question.
There's a couple years behind on the direct work and then a couple years behind on the people that like, if you ever have time, maybe we could talk about doing this.
Yeah. Well, that's the way it is, you know, and I'm grateful for this particular aspect. I've gotten to the point now where I could sell everything I could build. You know, I would never have to worry about that aspect of it. Mm-hmm. Just getting them built. Mm-hmm.
Sure. You talked a little bit about the fact that you have some future ideas that you weren't going to get into right now, but other than that.
Oh, those are pretty minor. Yeah.
Other than that, what?
No, not really.
Just keep on hammering.
I'm just kind of in my head. Yeah. Yeah. I like building these rifles and I like being able to take a break every now and again and take a few guys hunting. And, you know, for my lifestyle, that it's working out okay right now.
Awesome. Well, I think that you've really covered a great, you know, we've gone into some detail. You've really painted a good picture and just shared what you're doing. Man, you're doing some fantastic work. Like I said before, craftsmanship is something that's special. It's not just a slash and burn and making things happen. This is true craftsmanship, and I appreciate that greatly. I'm glad you're out there. And thank you so much for coming on the show today to tell us about it. And one of the things that I'll be doing is, you know, I'll create a YouTube presentation out of this. Basically, it's either just an MP3 with a picture, but if you are able to supply me with additional pictures, I can put those in the YouTube video as well.
Okay. No, I can. And I appreciate you inviting me. Thank you very much. I've enjoyed talking with you guys today very much.
I'm so glad you're here. And also, Destin, thank you for coming on here as well.
Thanks for having me on. I've never done a podcast, but it let me pontificate a little bit, so I enjoyed it.
Awesome. So we'll go ahead and wrap it up. Patrick, thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
Blue Collar Voices is produced by John Chapman, and all audio, video, graphics are created and edited by John Chapman. Blue Collar Voices is a DR7 Media production.
I'll be back.